From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Just a couple hours ago, President Trump announced he'll sign an emergency declaration for the U.S.-Mexico border. The move potentially allows him to redirect billions of dollars appropriated by Congress for other purposes toward a border wall. As the president admitted in his announcement, there are lawsuits ready to be filed the moment he signs. We'll examine the issues next. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you have a nice weekend in store, maybe even 3 days with Monday's President's Day holiday. Film Week is coming up in just an hour. We'll hear what our critics think of Alita: Battle Angel, new sci-fi adventure film co-written by James Cameron. Robert Rodriguez, the director of the film, Rosa Salazar, Christoph Waltz, and Mahershala Ali star in that film. And then the satirical romantic comedy Isn't It Romantic, starring Rebel Wilson and Liam Hemsworth. But first, after several weeks of musing about the move, President Trump announced his decision this morning.
I'm going to be signing today and registering national emergency. And it's a great thing to do because we have an invasion of drugs, invasion of gangs, invasion of people, and it's unacceptable. And by signing the national emergency, something signed many times by other presidents, many, many times, President Obama, in fact, we may be using one of the national emergencies that he signed having to do with cartels, criminal cartels. It's a very good emergency that he signed, and we're going to use parts of it in our dealings on cartels. So that would be a second national emergency, but in that case, it's already in place. And what we really want to do is simple. It's not like it's complicated. It's very simple. We want to stop drugs from coming into our country. We want to stop criminals and gangs from coming into our country. Nobody's done the job that we've ever done. I mean, nobody's done the job that we've done on the border.
The emergency declaration potentially allows the president to redirect funds designated for other purposes toward a U.S.-Mexico border barrier or a wall. But the president knows his declaration won't settle the matter.
I'll sign the final papers as soon as I get into the Oval Office, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there. And we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court. Just like the ban, they sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division, and then we went to the Supreme Court, and we won.
One of the few examples of President Trump using humor in one of his speeches. We're going to talk about the legal issues that are raised, the political dimensions of this as well. And from a practical matter, if the president prevails after all those legal challenges, what would actually happen along the U.S.-Mexico border? With us from the Los Angeles Times, D.C.-based immigration and security reporter Molly O'Toole. Molly, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So the president kind of mused about this for the past several weeks, unclear whether he was actually going to take this action or not. So what's the response on Capitol Hill with the announcement today?
There's been a lot of very, very strong language saying that essentially that the president has violated the separation of powers, that he's violating the Constitution because Congress has the power of the purse, and he's essentially ignoring that. They just passed a spending bill last night, which the president is expected to sign any moment now. It provides $1.357 billion for about 55 miles of border wall, but the president has said he will sign that bill, but he additionally declares the national emergency, and there's reporting Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, told reporters this morning that he's going for about $6.6 billion $1 billion from other federal other areas of the federal government in order to get the wall that he wants on the U.S.-Mexico border. So very strong language this morning from Capitol Hill warning him against doing this, including from conservative wings, suggesting that this is a dangerous precedent to set for potentially presidents down the line who they may not agree with, may not be aligned with, who could use this similarly to get what they want to go around Congress.
I had heard some earlier legal analysis, and I'm not sure whether I got this right, but it sounded like Congress could override the president on this. Is that at least an option available to Congress if it wanted to do that?
It is an option available. They essentially pass a resolution that could have the effect of rescinding the National Emergency Declaration. But they would have to do that with enough votes to be able to override President Trump's inevitable veto. It's not clear that they would have those votes. Also not clear necessarily that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi would kick off that process, by my understanding. Also not clear that she's going to be pursuing that route. That is an avenue that's available to them. That's effectively the only avenue that Congress could go down to try and prevent President Trump from taking this money from other areas of the federal government. When it comes to declaring a national emergency, there isn't much dispute that it is within his power to do this, whether or not you agree that it's justified.
Where are the funds expected to come from? Primarily the Pentagon, or has he indicated where he's going to get the several billion to do this?
Right. There's been some reporting, you know, and this is all pretty fast moving. He just declared, at least in words, just declared the national emergency a little over an hour ago. But Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney briefed reporters on a call this morning, along with a few other administration officials that weren't named, saying that he was going to look for about $6.6 billion for construction, and that most of that was going to come from funding for military construction projects. About $3.6 billion of the $6.6 billion would come from military construction projects. A little bit of money that the Pentagon has for combating drug trafficking, a little bit of money from Homeland Security, I believe, as well, that comes from combating drug trafficking, and a few other places, but a majority of the money would come from the military construction pot, so to speak, at the Pentagon.
Wouldn't be surprising if a number of state attorneys general decide to file a lawsuit, including Javier Becerra in California. And I wonder what potential legal standing there would be. You indicated a couple minutes ago that it looks like at least legally the president on firm ground. But is there a sense that a friendly court, like the president was saying, the Ninth Circuit, might actually side with the states on this?
Well, Becerra has already indicated that, even before the, basically as soon as the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said last night that the president had indicated he would declare a national emergency, Becerra already indicated that he would file suit. So that would sort of put it in the jurisdiction of the Ninth Circuit, which would rule on it. The president has complained a lot, claiming that the Ninth Circuit is somehow biased against him because the Ninth Circuit has been active in blocking a lot of his executive actions taken to pursue certain policies, particularly when it comes to immigration. So the Ninth Circuit blocked some of his asylum policies, when he tried to block people from declaring asylum between ports of entry, for example, as well as several iterations of the travel ban, although ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled on, I believe, it's the third iteration of the travel ban. So the president has complained a lot about the Ninth Circuit. That is likely where this sort of initial litigation would take place. There's a lot of debate about what the result could be. The president clearly believes the Ninth Circuit is sort of biased against him. I think a lot of judicial advocates and people who work in the judicial realm of government would say that there is no bias. They're ruling on the law, but it's unclear. He is on pretty firm ground to declare a national emergency. As the president said himself, national emergencies have been declared in the past. A lot of people are questioning the justification for the national emergency, but that's not necessarily a question of whether or not he has the authority as currently, written or existing in the law.
Molly, just before I let you go, I don't know how much information you have on this, but once the legal process is done, logistically, what's involved with the process of building this barrier or wall or whatever it's going to be? Have the locations been identified? Have the RFPs all gone out? What property acquisition issues are there? I mean, this sounds like there are just so many hurdles to do this.
If there are a lot of hurdles. Many of the areas have been identified. I mean, initially, so they're saying that they're going to use this money for about $6.6 billion for as much as 234 miles. We more or less know where they want to do that. It's not that hard to figure out. There are some contracts that have been issued. The 55 miles, for example, that were in the spending bill that Congress passed last night, which is the 1.357 number outside of the national emergency, those will all go in the Rio Grand Valley in Texas. And Texas is the main focus because Texas is the least fenced state. It has the most miles of border fencing, but it's the least fenced. A big reason for that. And so pretty much from the Pacific Ocean in California all the way through to New Mexico and west of El Paso in Texas is pretty much almost entirely fenced. There's 654 miles of fencing on the border right now in those areas built entirely by Trump's predecessors. He hasn't built a single new mile of wall on the border. He's only done construction projects for renovation. So that leaves Texas, and most of that is private land. So it's going to be a slow, arduous, extremely expensive process of putting that up in Texas because it will involve eminent domain. It will involve essentially paying people for their private land so that the government can use it to build a barrier, in addition to the fact that there's a lot of physical limitations to the border in Texas. A significant amount of the border in Texas is actually river. It's the Rio Grande. And so you'll have to build essentially fencing on top of levees. So there's a lot of environmental issues, physical barriers as well, that's going to make the next miles of fencing extremely difficult to do, especially if you're talking about 234 miles, which is what the Trump administration has said they're planning on doing.
That's even after the legal issues. And of course, then the question, the timing, if the president doesn't win re-election, would all of this be undone potentially by a Democratic successor? Molly O'Toole, Los Angeles Times, D.C.-based immigration and security reporter, thank you so much. We really appreciate your joining us.
Thank you.
We'll continue our conversation with our political analysts, Sean Walsh and Matt Rodriguez, and we have a pair of legal scholars who are also going to join us and share their perspectives on this. You're listening to AIR Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Just a reminder, Film Week coming up at 11 o'clock. Got a lot of new movies for our critics to weigh in on. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Film Week coming up at 11 o'clock today. And for this hour, we're taking a look at President Trump's announcement a couple hours ago that he is declaring a national emergency so that he can take several billion dollars allocated for other purposes and put it into security, a barrier along the U.S.-Mexico border. With us right now, Santa Clara University School of Law Professor Pradeepan Gulasekaram. Professor, thank you very much for being with us. Your thoughts about the legal issue here? Is the president on firm legal ground?
I think the president's going to be on quite shaky legal ground. The general constitutional background here is that only Congress is allowed to appropriate spending of money. Congress, in fact, has clearly considered the question whether a border wall should be funded and has rejected that request multiple times, most notably just in the last couple months. There are some, obviously you can declare an emergency, but the majority of the funds here, even after the declaration of emergency, would have to come from a reappropriation of Department of Defense funding. That funding is, if he's going to use it, has to be for a military use. It has to require the use of the armed forces. It has to be for a military construction project and in some way necessary to support the armed forces. I think it's quite difficult to make that argument about a border wall in this case.
And so you don't see it as the emergency, the declarative power here superseding those things and being kind of an exceptional power granted to the president?
So To be clear, the idea of declaring an emergency itself has no legal consequence other than the thing is declared an emergency. In order for that to have some sort of consequence in terms of an appropriation of funding or a reallocation of funding, we have to look to other statutes where Congress has specifically given the president the power to then move money. It's those statutes that limit the use of the Department of Defense funding to required military uses. And this is all against, as I mentioned before, the backdrop that the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, tells us that money cannot be spent by the federal government unless Congress authorizes it.
But so what if you've got, say, a natural disaster that occurs, the president does not have the latitude to reallocate funds for a natural emergency like that?
He does, but that is all pursuant to statutes that Congress has passed. An emergency, the president has, pursuant to statutory authority that Congress has given him in the National Emergencies Act, the ability to declare an emergency. That is not really the question. I mean, there's the legal latitude that the president has there is quite large. The idea of an emergency is not defined by Congress. But the idea of then, based on that emergency, triggering the ability to reallocate funds requires a look into whether Congress has authorized the president to do so. The way in which Congress has authorized the president to move large amounts of funds is to say you can take funds from Department of Defense funding that has not already been spoken for, and you can move them if you need it for a military construction project that is necessary to support the armed forces. That's the argument that the president's going to have to make.
We're talking with Professor Deep Gulasekaram of Santa Clara Law. Also with us, South Texas College of Law professor, associate professor of law, Josh Blackman. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me back.
Your response to the contentions made by Professor Gulasekaram.
The question here is not whether the president can declare an emergency. I think we agree largely on that. The question here is where will the president reallocate funds for? As a general matter, the president can only spend money that's been allocated, and Congress refused to fund the wall in its most recent budgetary disputes. But Congress has also allocated huge pots of money that aren't really earmarked. And the idea of an emergency, which doesn't really mean emergency, means it can move funds around. There's also a provision of law that's been in the books since 1991 that says the president can use some funds to construct fences along the border. So Congress has, whether it knows it or not, enacted a framework that could allow the president to actually construct some sort of barrier along the border. I think these statutes are very foolish, and they shouldn't give the president this much discretion. But here we are. We still haven't seen the executive order, so I'm in the dark somewhat. I don't know the exact basis of this process, but as soon as we get the order, I'll be sure to study it.
Well, and Professor Gulasekaram was making the point, if I understood him correctly, that there isn't really a military purpose here for the reallocation of these billions of dollars, and that would be necessary. How do you see it? Josh Blackman?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was a question.
Pardon me. Yeah, yeah.
Again, the statutory framework at issue here doesn't have to rely on the military building the wall. There's a provision of law that says that if the Department of Defense determines that there's a problem with drugs along the border, it can assist with the construction of fencing along the border. So we have this image of, you know, soldiers with shovels and picks building the wall. It's actually far more mundane. I think if the authority is there, you can just use the regular appropriations process to solicit bids. I do agree, though, that with your previous guest, if this goes to the courts, it'll be probably held up for the next 2 years or so. And if the President Trump loses reelection, we'll never actually see this wall being built. If he wins reelection and he prevails at the Supreme Court, like said he would, then this may actually be a way to construct the wall at some point in the near future.
We're talking with Josh Blackman. He's professor, South Texas College of Law, Houston. He's also author of Unraveled, Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power. And with us from Santa Clara Law, Professor Adeep Gulasekaram. Also joining us, talk about the political dimension of this, and we'll go back to the law professors in a little bit, is Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. Sean, good to have you with us again. I mean, how much of this is really political? The president, who was getting hammered by his base for signing this spending bill that didn't have anywhere near what he wanted for a wall, and trying to comply with that demand from his base.
Well, I think that's part of it. The other part is, at least this president seems to be doggedly committed to anything he said along his campaign trail, a promise that he made that he's going to try and fulfill that promise and do a checklist when he's running for re-election. So this is one of his big promises, and he's going to say promise made, promise kept. So he can blame the courts. But this is a big issue for him. It's been a big major issue for him, almost a central tenet of the administration's policies over the past 6 months. I think they miss other opportunities, but this is a big one for him, and it's all about, if he loses on this one, not only does he lose with the base, but I also think that they're going to say this guy can't get anything done.
What, as he runs for re-election and let's say he's still embroiled legally in pushback to the executive order, does that boost Republican turnout because they feel like whether the wall happens or not is dependent on Trump being elected?
Well, I think that does. It certainly solidifies his base. I will tell you, and I've said this before, the race was so close in so many states, and I know a number of Republican, moderate Republican, Bush Republicans who really didn't want to vote for President Trump. But when Ruth Bader Ginsburg came out and made her comments about President Trump and Supreme Court, they held their nose and said, look, it's too important. You need a president in there that will put Republican and conservative, or at least moderately conservative, judges in there. So that actually, I think, might have tipped the hand for the election. And that's exactly what he will do when he's running for office. Even if the thing is still tied up in the courts, he's going to say, that's why we need more, Republican judges in here to balance out the court. So politically, from a Republican base perspective, I think it's a win for him, both on the immigration side as well as on the judicial conservative side.
Republican political strategist Sean Walsh with us. We just got word a joint news conference will be held with Governor Newsom and State Attorney General Javier Becerra. That'll be at 11 o'clock, and you'll hear in Hetty's newscasts any news. It's expected that Javier Becerra, as soon as the president signs the emergency declaration, will file a lawsuit against the president trying to stop the inaction, the action to redirect those funds. Also with us, Democratic political strategist Matt Rodriguez. Matt, good morning. Do you think that this does potentially help the president in his reelection bid?
I don't know. We'll see. I've never liked this strategy. I don't understand what he's doing. To me, he could have potentially done this. What he should have done, to me at least, I don't think he should do this in the first place. But if he's going to do a national emergency, I don't know why he didn't do it originally before they had the shutdown. It seems to me that he's taking all of the hits, and the sequencing of this is all incorrect. So basically, he's been telegraphing a national emergency for a while. The polling is not good on this. It's about 2/3 against this. The public's not there. Instead, he runs head. At least if he had done this before the original shutdown, he could have then gone to where Sean has mentioned. He can just start blaming the courts, get it into the courts. He can sit there and say, I did this. He can suck up to his base doing that.
Liberal judges have stopped.
Liberal judges, this is terrible. Make America great again. The usual stuff that he does, that's good political ground for him. And it gets him to work with his base while at the same time getting this issue past him, because it's not a popular issue and his numbers are not good. And coming off of a huge loss in November of last year. And instead, he ends up going through a shutdown, which he's blamed for because he said he was going to shut the government down and he would take blame for it. His numbers have been tanking since then. The minute we get past this, he starts to get things. His numbers actually have been starting to stabilize again. Now he's plunging back into an extraordinarily unpopular policy. So I've never understood what his political calculation is on this because I don't understand what he's doing from a popularity point of view. And he's got his base. Where's his base going? Where are they going? Politics is about addition. It's not about just catering to your
base.
Well,
he's got, though, as his support has declined since the election,
yeah.
Doesn't he have to get that base motivated to come out? So if he's got conservative talk radio, Fox yeah. News commentators all blasting him
yeah.
over not holding firm in their view on a border wall,
yeah.
doesn't that hurt the turnout?
Well, he has shown a remarkable ability to just demolish anybody in his path, including conservatives. Ask Megyn Kelly what Megyn Kelly's doing right now. She doesn't even have a job. He has been able to kind of push through people who have criticized him. He did that through the entire 2016 election. He has given his base a lot. In this business, you have to find a way to do both. And generally, when you become a president, you do enough. He's done work on abortion that they like. He's done work on judges that they've liked. He's done a fair amount on immigration that they like. Just because Ann Coulter or Sean Hannity are ranting and raving on Fox News every night, he's shown a pretty unique ability to be Teflon with his base. And the talented politicians are able to do both. So I think that it's a huge political mistake to continue going after the 30% of the electorate that I don't think is ever going to go away from him while hemorrhaging all of the support that we've seen in suburban areas, in urban voters, college-educated women. I think that's the larger mistake for him if he wants to win re-election.
Sean, do you disagree with that?
I agree with Matt to the extent that there's a lot of other things he should be doing and talking about. I disagree with Matt to the extent that with regards to immigration, that is just a core central issue for his base. And if he is perceived as weak or walks away from that, I do think that is a serious crack in the foundation for him. Matt was correct, though. You know, were I advising the president, I would have laid this thing out very systematically and thoughtfully and rolled it out in a way that you're not herky-jerky. And he's been herky-jerky for the past 3 months, just really kind of careening like a pinball in a machine back and forth on what he's going to do. Now, he finally settled on this policy. It was interesting, the LA Times reported it was on at the beginning of the broadcast. I think she's right, too, with regards to the Republicans are loath for this policy because they do fear that a Democrat will get in and the Democrat will use whatever power to expand spending on any program that they basically want. So I know Mitch McConnell was very, very strong in cautioning the president not to take this course of action, and he did.
Well, and it's funny because, of course, Republicans were so critical of President Obama for all the executive orders and all the things that he did unilaterally in office, talking about what a bad president it was. And then, of course, under President Trump, he's had, many high-profile efforts to do similarly and more with this emergency declaration. And so I guess it's just left to the courts then, Sean, to sort of stop that further encroachment as the president takes on more and more power?
Well, it's interesting. So I've looked at John Yoo's analysis of going into this issue, and I haven't read any of the professors that are on the call here's views on these issues. But, you know, courts have historically been somewhat loath to get involved in defining executive branch matters. And I think they would rather let the legislative branch fight it out with the executive branch and let the legislative branch define exactly what the president's powers are. I mean, that's the beauty of our democracy. There's a push and pull here. Here, you may force the issue and you may get a decision that can either hem in the president or give the president broader discretion that both Republicans and Democrats may like and most likely dislike.
Josh Blackman, South Texas College of Law professor, your thoughts on the president going this route? Does that then, set a precedent in a way that's going to make the next president more apt to claim unilateral authority?
Well, as a matter of optics, absolutely. The entire notion of declaring an emergency makes people think of, Weimar Germany. As a legal matter, I think the question is much closer. We still don't know the exact executive order the president's using and what authority he is relying on. So if there's a statute that says the president can build a fence in the border, and he builds a fence in the border, that doesn't let the next president ban all guns or ban fossil fuels, whatever other pipe dreams the left has. So a lot will depend what the president actually does. But as an optics matter, Congress told the president, we don't want you building this wall. And the president now discovered an old statute that may give him the authority to build that wall. And that, I think that will sit very badly. My sincere hope, and I mean this, is that Congress overrides this declaration and overrides a veto, in fact, and says, you can't do this.
Deep Gulasekaram, Professor, Santa Clara Law, your thoughts on this and the potential precedent here.
I agree with much of what Professor Blackmun was saying. I think in the general problem here is that the president is talking to two audiences. One is the courts, the United States federal courts, in which perhaps there is a chance that simply the invocation of the magic words national security might allow them to say that, at least at the Supreme Court level, maybe we give deference to the president. But the other audience here is the American public. And here, I think, there's a real problem when the president decides to take money that has not been allocated, in fact, not just has not been allocated, but has several times has asked Congress for this specific allocation and has been rejected, and then uses it in a way that we, the people, have not approved. This is within the larger context where he's making a claim about an emergency at the southern border, an emergency that really can't be supported by underlying facts. Unlawful border crossings are at historic lows. The people coming from Central America, where there is an actual humanitarian crisis in Central America, are actually asking to present themselves at the border. There is no evidence of terrorist activity coming through the southern border of the United States. His own DEA is telling you that a very small amount of opioids actually come through in between border crossings. In fact, most of the unlawful drugs coming to the United States come through ports of entry, not through places where the wall is going to be.
Which is interesting because the president directly contradicted that in his announcement this morning, Professor. He said that's an inaccurate claim.
You can keep saying things over and over again. That doesn't make it true. I think we've seen that this president has significant problems with the credibility of the facts that he has and the credibility of those people speaking with for him on those facts. But the fact is, if you look at the Department of the Drug Enforcement Agency's own website, they will tell you that information. DHS's own statistics, the State Department's own statistics, will tell you that the southern border of the United States is not a significant place for terrorists to come through, and that counterterrorism dollars and intelligence are not spent stopping people at the southern border of the United States.
Gentlemen, I need to break, but for our two legal scholars, in case you haven't seen this, the Supreme Court just announced they will do a speedy review of a lower court ruling about the 2020 census question on citizenship. This the question is to whether the federal government can ask someone filling out their census form whether they are a U.S. citizen. And there have been lawsuits to try and fight that, claiming that it will decrease participation in the U.S. Census. So the high court will hear arguments in late April. A decision about the census citizenship question should come by late June. My thanks to our legal scholars, Deep Gulasekaram of Santa Clara Law and Josh Blackmun, South Texas College of Law, Houston. We'll continue with Matt and Sean and more guests. But first, a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Film Week, just 18 minutes from now, the sci-fi adventure Alita Battle Angel, directed by Robert Rodriguez, stars Rosa Salazar, Christoph Waltz, and Mahershala Ali. James Cameron, one of the screenwriters. The satirical romantic comedy Isn't It Romantic, starring Rebel Wilson and Liam Hemsworth. And the horror film, got to have the obligatory Valentine's weekend horror film. Always seems like that's the case. Happy Death Day to You, from writer-director Christopher Landon. We'll hear what Amy Nicholson thinks about that movie coming up on Film Week in just about 17 minutes now. Right now, our focus on President Trump's somewhat rambling announcement this morning in the Rose Garden that he's going to sign an emergency declaration for the U.S.-Mexico border, enabling him to redirect billions of dollars from money allocated by Congress for other purposes to construction of a border barrier or wall in the areas where there is not much of a barrier currently. We're talking with political strategist Matt Rodriguez, the Democrat, Sean Walsh, the Republican. Let me bring into the conversation at this point Julian Aguilar, who's Texas Tribune immigration and border security reporter. Julian, thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. So what's the response in Texas to this, and you know where are the areas where fencing or a wall would be built?
Well, the response so far by lawmakers, especially the border lawmakers, border Democrats, was swift and expected. You know, they're gonna fight tooth and nail to see what they have in their toolbox to challenge this and not implement it. And I think the president conceded as much this morning during what you accurately described as a sort of a rambling speech and announcement, where he was asked about the backlash that even some Republicans have expressed, and he said, you know, that'll be up to the courts to decide. So I doubt that we'll see the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, breaking ground on anything with respect to this emergency declaration immediately. But with respect to the geographical challenges, you know, I'm in El Paso, Texas right now, where there is current barrier and current fencing, but a lot of it is on land that was already controlled by the federal government, very close to the Rio Grande, or what we call Rio Grande here, which in some places is nothing more than a reinforced sort of concrete channel where the river flows. And then out in the more rural areas, there's more fencing where there's an actual river, a natural river, but that's very close to the river there. But you go down south, downriver to the Rio Grande Valley, for example, you have current fencing, say, in Cameron County and Hidalgo County, that's actually a mile up north of the Rio Grande. So two main arguments here with respect to why this is such a concern is imminent. We did a project in coordination with ProPublica a couple years ago called The Taking, and there are still certain court challenges where private landowners sued the federal government to stop them from taking their land that are still pending. And these have been going on for, you know, years and years, if not a decade. This was all the result of the 2006 Secure Fence Act. But also the where the barrier was built and the folks that did allow the government to pay them, you know, they say that their land south of the fence, and like again, in some cases, it's several acres of land. They say that it was rendered useless just because they have no access to it.
So. No man's land, right? Because the other side of the fence, but still in the U.S.
Exactly, and that's the second point. It said, you know, if the key is to stop people from coming into the country to seek asylum, for example, they're going to be south of whatever is constructed, but they're still north of the Rio Grande in the United States. And according to court and law, they're going to be south of the fence. They're going to wave themselves down. They're going to be apprehended by Border Patrol, but they're still going to have the ability to seek asylum. So I think these are a lot of the questions that lawmakers in Texas have been asking. They've yet to get satisfied with the responses so far. But what we saw today was obviously, I think, what we expected. The president campaigned on this. He swore that he was going to do this. And now I guess it'll be up to the courts and, you know, probably a circuit court. And eventually maybe the Supreme Court. Who knows how high it's going to go. I think your other guests would probably shed a little bit more light on that.
Julian, thank you so much. Appreciate your talking with us about what's going on in Texas and the response and the complexities of putting any kind of permanent barrier along that area of the Rio Grande Valley. We appreciate it. Julian Aguilar of the Texas Tribune, also with us for the Arizona Republic and the U.S. Today Network, reporter covering the border, Rafael Carranza. Thank you very much for being with us, Rafael. So in Arizona, if I'm not mistaken, aren't there Native American populations and indigenous populations on the Mexico side of the border where there are conflicts there?
Yeah, there is the Tohono O'odham Nation. It's one of the largest, tribal lands by size in the entire United States. It spans, you know, several miles of the international border, and they have members who live on both sides. And, you know, something that they continually talk about is that, you know, they were there long before the border existed and will continue to be here long after this border existed. So they are very much in opposition of any additional plans to build additional barriers, especially through their areas. They've already seen current security measures impact some of their activities. There are certain crossings that are only available to tribal members, and you can cross back and forth into Mexico and the United States using the tribal card. But that has become increasingly difficult because of, you know, the security challenges and the enforcement that has been added over the past few years.
And is there particular legal standing as a Native American nation that they could potentially, you know, hold this up because of, you know, a special authority that they might have?
Well, I think it's the issue of tribal sovereignty that comes into play here, and it's weighing the issues of tribal sovereignty against the national security interest. And I think that that's kind of the frontier where it might play out. I know that the tribal leaders at the Tohono O'odham Nation feel very strongly that they have a very strong case, for being able to operate on their lands as they please, and not allowing the federal government to build these barriers on there. They say they have the support of other tribal nations as well. But as we've seen, you know, the federal government has also been pursuing stricter measures moving forward. And so I think as that continues playing out, we might see that clash head on.
We're talking with Rafael Carranza of the Arizona Republic. He covers the border, also reports for the USA Today Network. What about the topographical challenges in southern Arizona along the border? You've got a lot of mountains and the like. Are there areas where it would be virtually impossible to fence?
There certainly is, and I think that's also the case, for California and New Mexico as well. These are very remote, isolated areas, and in many circumstances, many cases, you have these vast, rugged mountain ranges that go from north to south into both countries. And in some of these areas, it would be practically impossible to build any infrastructure, any fence, or just anything to access those areas. And that obviously raises a lot of questions as well. If these areas are so remote, is how are you going to be able to get all of the materials, the workers, and everything in place to build these additional infrastructure?
Rafael, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it very much. Rafael Carranza is based in Tucson, reports on the border region for the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. We'll continue on Air Talk, hear more from our political strategists about that dimension of President Trump's announcement just about an hour before we came on the air that he will sign an emergency declaration for the U.S.-Mexico border region. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle joined by political analysts Matt Rodriguez and Sean Walsh. Hey, Sean, before we conclude, I wanted to ask you about the president's announcement, the Rose Garden, today at the White House. He'll often work without a teleprompter and be somewhat scattered. I thought today that it was even more so than usual. He seemed all over the place, unfocused, distracted. Are Republicans at all concerned with the way he's presenting himself, generally in speeches, but particularly with today's, the way he did the announcement?
I think they're less concerned about the way he did the announcement. And at least in this case, he's going in front of, the media and the public, and where it may be scattered. It was almost sing-song. It was kind of a weird cadence he had. But at least you're getting some articulation, even if as awkward as it is, on what he's thinking, as opposed to, 15 characters on a tweet. So, take your wins where you can get them, I guess, from a Republican side. The thing that they were really unhappy about, Larry, is just getting jerked around. I mean, they didn't know if he was going to sign this bill or not sign this bill. There's a big CODEL mission that's getting ready to go to Munich for a national security issue that a lot of Republicans and Nancy Pelosi was involved in. And just to do the functioning business that they need to do in Congress, they get almost no certainty from President Trump ever. So it just drives him nuts, and it makes him mad, and it makes him a little bit mad that he doesn't seem to take seriously the counsel they give him when it talks about executive authority and what this could do in the future. Now, not that they expect him to do everything they want him to do, but they do expect him to listen to him at least thoughtfully and give analysis and feedback on what they're presenting.
Well, Matt, it's funny because Democrats often expressed unhappiness with President Obama that he didn't come over and talk. He didn't do the massaging that presidents often do.
Yeah.
This seems far more extreme than sort of the lack of attention of President Obama.
Yeah.
This is like sort of flagrantly leaving him to flap in the wind.
Well, this has been the issue for the first 2 years of his presidency and is going to potentially continue, which he's putting them in a very difficult position. There are going to be some members of the Republican caucus who are up for re-election, someone like Susan Collins, who's got to be careful on something like this because her state is not that – there are parts that are conservative, but she's got to think about her general election. Then there's people like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell who are also up. You saw Mitch McConnell immediately come out and support it. I guarantee you in his heart of hearts, Mitch McConnell thinks this is a bird brain idea. But he's up for re-election, and he doesn't want to get primaried. And this is the problem. He's continually putting these members into these terrible positions. There was historic losses in November. We're talking 9.5% of the country, a win for Democrats. That's a huge loss, especially for usually a whiter, more conservative electorate in an off-year election. And once again, anything that the Republicans want to be talking about, I'm sure it's not this, but whether it's because of executive power overreach, whether it's because the border stuff can be potentially problematic for them, whether it's just Trump's general, it was almost like he was singing a nursery rhyme or something during half of the press conference. So none of this is good for them, but they're beholden to him, and where they're starting to run headlong into 2020 here. So they're tied to this guy, but I would not have a lot of confidence watching what he did today. In addition to everything that's happened now over the last 2 months, they still can't get past this shutdown and the national emergency. It's been going on for a few months now. They must be just like apoplectic about it.
So, and of course, the Democratic Party it can't really take full advantage of this politically because it's got its own fires going on with this huge field of presidential candidates.
Right. And we've talked about this. At the end of the day, right now the party has a lot of splits coming. And this is what I've always found to be crazy about the Republicans is there's a big split in the Democratic Party coming. We're seeing it actually play out in the Amazon.
The Amazon is the template for that.
Is the template for real. There's real angst. And Governor Cuomo was very angry about what happened. You have the left part of the party that is crowing up and down about this, but there's larger issues and questions about, well, what does it mean to have a job and economic development and capitalism and all of this? Where that's going to land, I don't know. That's going to take time to play out. But the Democrats have some real fissures that are coming, and we're starting to see them play out at a very early time frame. But none of that is getting any kind of play right now because Trump is sort of so off the rails once again. So I've never been clear as to what his strategy is here. I think Republicans have to hope that they can kind of get past this. This moves into the courts, and then they can just like sort of be done with it in the sense that it'll be on its own autopilot for a while, and then they can try to move on to other business because this is just not helping Republicans at all. It is an unpopular issue with the country at large, and Republicans gain really nothing by having this fight continually.
Sean, quick final word on that. You disagree with Matt on his contention?
I don't. The only thing I would say in President Obama's defense, and I don't often defend President Obama, the staff of Obama did communicate very frequently with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. So at least you kind of knew what he was thinking. Now, he may have shined on the members of Congress, but the staff was well informed. Here, it's like a Ouija board. It moves around mysteriously, and you never know what you're going to get from one moment.
Yeah,
that's a good quote, Sean.
I thought Trump's head was going to spin around during the press conference too. It all fits.
Gentlemen, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Nice
appreciate it. Sean Walsh, Republican political strategist. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, joining us regularly on Air Talk. And we remind you, of course, Tuesday of next week, because we'll be off for the press. President's Day holiday on Monday. Tuesday, we'll have our politics roundup and be talking about the big issues over the long weekend. I want to take a moment to thank our wonderful AirTalk team. They are so diligent, and every day, it's funny, we do a post-show email that Fiona Ng, our senior producer, puts out, and it's like, wow, you guys really came through. Great guests at the last minute. So true. I'm deeply indebted to the great team led by Fiona Ng. Our producers are Matt D'Angelo-Antonio and Natalie Chudnovsky. We had help this week from Audrey Noe and Kaylee Wells. Our news apprentices are Itzy Quintanilla and Matt Bynum. Our terrific technical director, Ethan Service. All right, we have Film Week that's coming up momentarily. Got a lot of movies to talk about. Peter Rayner is also back from the Santa Barbara Film Festival, which grows each year. We'll hear about his favorites there. Tell you about it in a moment. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. As we head into a three-day President's Day weekend, Sunday afternoon, all our critics on stage, Theater at Ace Hotel downtown, for our annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. I can't believe it would be the 17th year. Our first years were at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, and the event became so big we couldn't fit it in the Egyptian. Now we are in the much larger historic theater that began life as the United Artists, the Theater at Ace Hotel on South Broadway. We still have some tickets that are available. They are getting a little short, but you can get yours at kpecc.org/in-person. I'm very pleased to be joined this week by film critics Amy Nicholson, who writes on film for The Guardian and hosts the podcast The Canon and Unspooled. Peter Rayner is film critic for the Christian Science Monitor and just back from the Santa Barbara Film Festival in that beautiful city. He'll tell us about that later. And Charles Solomon, animation critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with Alita Battle Angel, sci-fi action-adventure directed by Robert Rodriguez. He co-wrote the screenplay with James Cameron. It's based on the manga Battle Angel Alita by Yukito Kishiro, about a deactivated female cyborg who's revived but can't remember anything of her past life.
You've been given a chance to start over with a clean slate. How many of us get that?
Why did an enemy warship respond to me? Because I knew that ship. I've been on others like it, haven't I? Haven't I?
Oh, whatever you were, it's not who you are now.
I'm a warrior, aren't I?
Rosa Salazar, Christoph Waltz, Mahershala Ali, Jennifer Connelly star in Alita Battle Angel. Before we hear our critics' opinions about the film, Charles, can you give us a little background on the evolution of the movie?
Well, this is something Cameron's been talking about since at least 2004. I found things where he proclaimed they were going to make it this way. This is very much almost a genre of manga and anime, the post-apocalyptic dystopia that's in ruins. Some of it comes from, I'm blanking on the name of the film, Blade Runner. The original was very influential. But also, Japan is the only country that has ever experienced a nuclear attack. And so, as well as having disastrous weather and earthquakes, so that kind of setting runs through a lot of anime and manga, as does the kind of amnesiac female warrior. That's Major Kusanagi in Ghost in the Shell, any number of things. Also part of it that I would expect to hear some feminist critics talking about is that these characters often acquire either armor or a cyborg body that kind of simultaneously empowers and degrades, that it gives them the power to, you know, punch through things and kick through things and leap over things. But it also involves a structure that would make Barbie feel under endowed.
So sexualized,
yeah,
as well.
Very, very much sexualized. And again, Wonder Woman looks like, just can't compare to some of these heroines.
We're talking about Alita Battle Angel. What did you think about it, Peter?
I sort of enjoyed it. The buzz on this was not good, and so I went in, you know, expecting a colossal disaster, and I thought it was kind of fun. It's sort of overlong and overstuffed, but the Rosa Salazar is quite good. As you know, it's good performance capture work, I think, in this film. You know, there's a lot of dystopian stuff that goes on. The most of it's taking place in this Iron City, which is essentially one big junkyard. Christoph Waltz is for a change playing a good guy, although for a while it seems like he might not be a good guy. There's a game called Motorball that's very much like Rollerball that's in this movie. It's violent, but not in a way that's, you know, offensive or out there.
PG-13 rating.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the hugest fan of these kinds of films, and I'm not sure that this was worth 15 years in the making and then some. Of course, it's set up for a sequel, as all these films are. But I guess Cameron himself was going to direct this way back when, and then he got so involved with the Avatar sequels that he handed it off to Rodriguez, who has some experience with, you know, Sin City in this genre. So, you know, I mean, I thought it was enjoyable enough.
Amy, what do you think of Alita: Battle Angel?
Well, I probably spent the first hour of it rolling my eyes, and then at the end, I was completely won over. The final half hour is like, you've got me. Fine, I'd see another battle, Alita Angel. I keep getting the words all in different orders because it's just the Scrabble title. But, yeah, I mean, to Charles's point about, like, the female bodies in here, you know, she begins as sort of a prepubescent girl, and then when she gets a little bit older into the movie, she gets to swap out her body, and it has, I would say, a slightly bigger chest.
Slightly
bigger chest. I mean, I couldn't help half of the time that I was watching this movie thinking like, oh, this is designed for like people at home, nerds, their dream girlfriend. You know, she's got a perfect figure. She'll beat up anybody who messes with you. She's great at sports. You know, she's really adventurous.
She'll give you her heart.
She'll literally give you her heart. Her Exactly. One of the things that happens really early on is she like falls in love with the first boy she really sees, and their romance, it's actually very much a romantic film, kind of carries the plot of it. It's not so much like vengeance. The main thing that's on her mind is, I love my boyfriend. Oh my God. And you know, it actually does feel like a young girl in love with her boyfriend. It's a little bit idealized. She's like, I'm on the back of your motorcycle, honey. One thing I thought was sort of funny is like her boyfriend's friends keep calling her a hard body because she's, you know, built of different parts. But that's exactly what the people in American Psycho call like hot women. And so I was wondering how much James Cameron was thinking of that. It kept striking me as just super bizarre.
Well, remember the Terminator movies, you know.
It's a liquid body in the second one.
Yeah.
What did you think, Charles?
I'm the least enthusiastic of us. I believe in recycling and reusing, but not necessarily in filmmaking. There are big chunks of, again, Blade Runner and Akira and Ghost in the Shell and Appleseed and any number of anime films in it. And for what it cost, you could have made between 20 and 30 anime features that I think would be more effective. For some reason, they give her these enormous eyes that look like fried eggs. They're so big. I guess it's trying to emulate that look from manga and anime, but it's kind of creepy. Most of the mocap is pretty good, though there are some uneven spots where clearly it looks as if shots have been farmed out and that not everybody could handle the models as well as others. For what it cost and the time I spent watching it, I think there are more interesting things you can do in a similar vein.
I'm curious about the dialogue that's been for James Cameron to bit to me is Achilles' heel, is dialogue. How is it here, Peter?
I thought it was acceptable. I mean, I didn't hear too many clinkers. It's not, you know, we're not talking Bob Town dialogue here. But
or Noel Coward.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I think Jennifer Connelly gets one real clinker of a line. She's like, I am a mother.
Yeah,
I mean, I had forgotten
Christoph
that.
Waltz. You know, whenever you see Christoph Waltz, you're expecting Tarantino dialogue. So you don't get that here.
There are three screenwriters credited for the film. Cameron's, I mentioned, the director, Robert Rodriguez, and Laeta Kalogridis, who also one of the three screenwriters of the film. Alita: Battle Angel, rated PG-13 in wide release. The satirical romantic comedy, Isn't It Romantic?, stars Rebel Wilson and Liam Hemsworth. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, well, the big studio rom-com is back, baby. I'm excited about this. I've been waiting for these films for basically 10 years. We haven't had gigantic studio romantic comedies of this size, of this ambition, and of a movie that basically just makes fun of everything that came before. Isn't It Romantic is one of its many writers is Katie Silberman, who did Set It Up this summer. Like the romantic comedy that I think really started to get this motor running of how people really do want to see romantic comedies again. And here this is a film where she basically has a character, Rebel Wilson, who does not believe in any sort of romance, hates romantic comedies, begins the movie with a tirade of every single cliche from every Reese Witherspoon, Julia Roberts film, which you know that then she will have to perform.
Let's hear an example of it from Isn't It Romantic, directed by Todd Strauss-Schulzen, about a young woman disenchanted with love, mysteriously finding herself trapped in an alternate universe.
Now I have a gay sidekick. This is sending gay rides back like 100 years.
I love working the legs.
And guys looking me in the eyes.
You're quite beguiling, aren't you?
Are you feeling what I'm feeling?
No!
Bit of an example of what you're talking about, Amy.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to picture this rom-com world that she wakes up in after she hits her head, there's cupcake stores everywhere, bridal stores, flowers everywhere. She's allergic to flowers. People who love romantic comedies will notice that whenever she has to go to a dinner scene, she's, you know, dressed up like Julia Roberts exactly in Pretty Woman. You know, I sat next to Peter for this in movie, and I will say that I laughed a lot, and he was stone cold silent. But
I didn't hear you laughing a lot.
I did. Maybe I was.
It was the sound of one hand laughing. Right.
Peter, what did you think?
I brought a tape recorder to that screening. Okay, I think anti cliches are just as annoying as cliches, and. I mean, yes, it's sort of funny to see them run through, you know, there's the gay best friend, there's the makeover montage, there's a slow-mo race to stop the wedding scene. You know, there's all of these cliches that are part of rom-com lore. But part of it is that I don't find Rebel Wilson to be a terribly engaging, funny comedian in the way that, say, Melissa McCarthy is in these kinds of roles. And I also thought that there was too much. She's too quick to not like this rom-com world that she's in before she turns on it. So to me, there wasn't enough of a disparity between, oh, wow, this is amazing. Everyone loves me, this handsome guy and everything. You know, there should have been more of that to then, you know, after a while say, well, gee, this isn't really what I want. You know, and there's the one boyfriend who sees her for what she is, and you know, and unlike everyone else in the paradise rom-com world, is sees her for what she is. You know, I don't know. I just thought it was a variation on something that they were making fun of, but they were also playing into it.
All right, the film is Isn't It Romantic, rated PG-13. Erin Cardillo, Dana Fox, and Katie Silberman are the screenwriters. Happy Death Day to You is our Valentine's Day horror film, sequel to 2017's Happy Death Day, written and directed by Christopher Landon, stars Jessica Roth, who returns as college student Tree Gelpman, and will have to once again die to save her friends.
Everything's different this time.
Now,
the killer is coming after all of us.
Ryan!
That means I'm going to have to die over.
Bye!
And over again to save all of you.
Damn, this is crazy, man.
Happy Death Day to you, Amy.
Well, so Happy Death Day, if anybody out there saw that, which a lot of people did, that's why there's a sequel, is about a sorority girl, you know, terrible blonde, horrible, mean, who keeps reliving this night of a one-night stand where she wakes up in a strange guy's bed and then has to figure out, like, how she's going to get murdered by the end of the day. That was more of a straight horror film. You know, people were jumping out of closets, you know, creepy baby mask men with knives. This is more just a straight comedy. They're just sort of leaning into Tree herself because Jessica Roth is really funny in these movies. You know, she's got the big blonde hair and her exasperation at being back in a series of wake-ups in the same bed again. She's just so fed up with it. The plot, basically, what's happening here is that what started her death loop was this, like, invention that these nerds are building on campus. And so she meets the nerds and realizes they split her into an alternate reality. And now she wants to combine her realities and be back in the correct one. To do that, she has to give them time to work on the machine, which means every day she just has to kill herself so that they get more time to, like, keep building their science experiment. And she is just so ferocious and mad about it and hilarious. And then she gets good at math, of course. And there's comedy in the sorority girl getting good at math. I mean, this film is basically just ridiculous nonsense. And I had a ton of fun.
Okay. Right.
I guess the theme for this week is alternate realities.
Yes, it
is. Really
is. Yeah. Happy Death Day to you. Jessica Roth stars Christopher Landon, the writer-director, rated PG-13, and it is in wide release. We have many more films to talk about this week, including the biographical comedic drama Fighting With My Family, Lords of Chaos, and Birds of Passage. That's all to come up right here on Film Week on KPCC. But time is running short. If you want to get your tickets to join us Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, it's the 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. Our critics will be there on stage in the beautiful, historic Theater at Ace Hotel. Began life as the United Artists. And I can't tell you what a great feeling it is to sit in a group of more than 1,000 film lovers watching on this huge screen the clips that we've chosen for the Best Picture nominees, to see those great performances, beautifully shot films. Your tickets are available at kpcc.org/in-person. Looking forward to seeing you Sunday afternoon at 1. We're back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're just talking during that minute about the Oscars and how they're going to give out some of the awards during the breaks. I think cinematography and film editing are going to be during the commercials.
Yeah. Right. Disaster.
It's nice to know that you know, if you're a cinematographer, you're going to be part of the bathroom break.
Well,
it's not like your work is important in the film.
Setting aside the statement about those categories, just logistically, trying to have people who aren't, you know, the full host of the telecast, experience live TV people, fit those awards into the breaks without running over. This is going to be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, and they're going to edit these speeches as the show is going on, so they can show little blips from the acceptance speeches later on in the show. So technically, the categories will be there, you know, on screen, but who knows who's going to be doing the editing and what, you know. And just one quick point, if this is all about, you know, saving time on the show, how is it that the same Academy wanted to create a popular film award that got shot down last summer, you know, which would have certainly added another half an hour to the show with 10 nominees, right?
All right. Well, the Oscars, of course, coming up in a couple of weekends next weekend, I should say. And our Film Week Oscar show coming up this weekend, Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. We continue with this week's films with Fighting With My Family. It's a British-UK co-production biographical comedic drama starring Florence Pugh, Jack Lowden, and Nick Frost. It's written and directed by Stephen Merchant. Peter?
This is pretty terrific, and it's not a rock movie, and they're sort of promoting it that way. He's in the ads. He's in it for about 7 minutes. It's based on a real family, the Knight family. There was a documentary in 2012 about them, a wrestling family, and the daughter, you know, became a big wrestling star named Paige, professional name. And Florence Pugh, who plays Paige in the film, is a marvelous actress. She was in a film a couple of years ago, you know, Lady Macbeth. And she's been in, you know, other...
Talk about totally different role.
Yeah. I mean, she's very versatile. Here she's playing a sort of, you know, goth, a girl from, you know, Norwich, England. And she, you know, she's got a nose ring and a lip ring, excuse me. And you know, it. But she and her brother are both chosen to try out for the WWE. And he's not picked. Very good actor named Jack Lowden. So he's kind of resentful of that, but she goes to the kind of minor league WWE boot camp run by Vince Vaughn. Very good performance. And she's up against all these, you know, Barbies and fitness models who are also there. But one of the very nice things about the movie is that these fitness models turn out to be full-fledged characters who have real lives, and, you know, you understand why they're doing this. And, you know, one is doing it to, you know, because she needs to pay for her daughter's education and so forth. You know, I mean, everyone in this movie is a fully rounded character. Nick Frost and Lena Headey play the parents, and they're both wonderful. The wrestling scenes are well done. Stephen Merchant, who wrote and directed it, is an actor, writer, director from England who's best known for the UK version of The Office, very different from this film. So, I mean, it's predictable, We know how it's going to turn out, but that doesn't matter because what you are watching all along the way is so entertaining.
Matt D'Angelo Antonio, our producer, is saying that Paige herself was a goth girl from England and really famous in the WWE women's division until 2017 when injuries forced her retirement.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I don't watch a whole lot of wrestling, but my
image. But the bit you do.
No, when I was a kid, I used to, you know, Haystacks Calhoun and you know, all those guys. But I just remember Max von Sydow and Hannah and her sisters, that scene where he's watching wrestling on TV. And he goes, imagine the mentality of the people who watch this stuff. You don't have to love wrestling to like this movie.
Fighting with My Family, written and directed by Stephen Merchant, rated PG-13.
I should say wrestling, quote unquote, because there's a funny moment in the movie where somebody refers to what they do as fake. And he goes, it's not fake, it's fixed.
The film is screening at the ArcLight Hollywood and the AMC Century City. Lords of Chaos, a biographical horror film starring Rory Culkin and Emery Cohen. Jonas Åkerlund is the director and co-screenwriter. Amy.
I love this film, and I've been waiting for this film to come out since last year, Sundance. It was tied as one of my top two favorite films of Sorry to Bother You last year. This film is about the Norwegian black metal scene in the late 80s, early 90s. And Jonas Åkerlund was sort of a distant part of it. He was in Sweden in a group called Bathory. So this is a scene he knows well. Like, Norwegian black metal, picture corpse paint, you know, the black goo kind of dripping down from your eyes. And picture these three people, real-life characters, Euronymous, Varg, and Dead. They were three people who were, like, part of this band scenes, and there were murders involved. They burned churches. They did a lot of things. One of them wound up dead. One of them wound up in prison. And this is sort of a comic story-ish about them. Because what...
A comic story of satanic metal.
It is, because what Jonas Åkerlund does really smart is he makes this film sort of about poser ideas, about these kids trying to look tough and really upping the stakes for each other, about, like, their influence on each other to try to be the most evil, the most sinister, you know, to leave voicemails that say things like, we can't come to the phone right now because we're too busy sacrificing children. I mean, he understands that these guys were terrifying and did terrible things and were also kind of a joke and were also really deeply insecure. And so I just enjoy this film so much. You know, he has this really good eye for things like capturing Varg, who went on to make music under the name Burzum, which is pretty well known. He still makes music today. Like, alone in his room, in corpse paint, eating a piece of toast. And so I just found this film incredibly delightful. I think he has, like, Jonas Åkerlund, he comes out of the music video world, so he has a really great eye for things. He has a great eye for the energy. There's a lot of tongues out and devil horns. And I thought a lot of emotion. So I really hope people check out this film.
It's based on the book Lords of Chaos, The Bloody Rise of the Satanic Metal Underground. Lords of Chaos, the film, is rated R. It's at the Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills. Birds of Passage, a Colombian film starring Carmina Martinez, and it's directed by Cristina Gallego and Ciro Guerra. The film's unrated. Amy?
Yeah, this is sort of the Colombian Godfather, I would say. You know, a film about the rise of the drug industry in a rural part of Colombia from the 60s to the 80s. You know, a few families in charge of it, a few families and their friends. And yet it is completely its own distinct movie because it really sets this not in the world of, like, slick dudes. It doesn't look at all like how you're picturing. It's set among the rural tribe of these indigenous people called the Wayuu, who began to become marijuana farmers and marijuana traffickers while bringing with it, like, their own set of culture and their own set of houses and their own set of beliefs. Like, it looks very unique, unlike any other film you've ever seen about this kind of story. You might think that if you watch Birds of Passage that the arcs of it are true. You know, there's, like, a screw-up son who's basically, like, the Fredo who comes in with this ridiculous afro. And yet, like, this film, I thought, just had such a distinctive personality and a really beautiful cinematography. There's a lot of deaths, of course, and, you know, you might be like, I know exactly what's going to happen here. However, I really thought that this film was doing something unique and special. If you're a mafia movie person, which I am not, this is, like, the type of mafia movie you might really like. That might add something to your mafia rainbow.
Birds of Passage, Peter?
Yeah, I would say it's The Godfather is a bit of a stretch. It's sort of like the Colombian Loving Pablo in some ways. I mean, it is a fascinating movie because it does deal with a real subject, you know, in the 70s, you know, the Wayuus, which are, you know, very traditional indigenous people. You know, the drug traffic sort of infiltrated the community and ripped it apart. And I guess, you know, at its best, that's what this movie is about. Marijuana is actually the main drug here, and it started out by selling marijuana to gringos who were there, you know, and then it sort of escalated from there. But I think, for me, the magical realist aspects of this movie were fascinating, but it didn't go quite far enough. Whenever you were sort of in the territory of Embrace of the Serpent, which was a film that this couple did previous to this, the directors, it was at its most fascinating, but then it sort of moved into more of a sort of traditional, gang drug stuff, which you've seen before, even though this is a new setting. So it didn't hold my interest in that. But the matriarch of the clan, played by Carmina Martinez, is quite imposing. And there's a wonderful scene early on, a kind of courtship dance between the young daughter who sort of is coming out and is have this. I don't know what the exact name of the dance is, but it's a fascinating piece of indigenous culture. I wish there was more of that in the movie.
Birds of Passage, the film, it's directed by Christina Gallego and Ciro Guerra, who were both interviewed by The Frame's John Horn. If you'd like to hear that conversation with the directors of Birds of Passage, you can go to our Film Week page, kpcc.org. We have a link to it there. Birds of Passage is unrated. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Mirai is one of the five nominees for Best Animated Feature at this year's Oscars. The Japanese film is written and directed by Mamoru Hosoda. Charles, Mirai, I know you're very high on this film.
Yeah, well, in the last several years, Hosoda has emerged as one of the most interesting writer-directors working in animation, not just in Japan, but I think period. And while this isn't my favorite of his films, it's very charming. It's about a little boy named Kun, who is happily spoiled, and then the unthinkable happens. His parents bring home a baby sister, and suddenly he is no longer the center of the family universe. And through a series of magical adventures, he interacts with different family members. He meets his mother, who's always telling him to pick up his toys, as a little girl who is an absolute terror. He meets his grandfather, whose advice he learns and becomes able to ride a bike. Very warm, very charming, very different from all the other nominees, and well worth seeing.
And we remind you that we'll spend considerable time, our Film Week Academy Awards preview, at the Theater at Ace Hotel on Sunday, on the category of Best Animated Feature. Mirai is showing at Lemley's Glendale and Lemley's Monica Film Center over the next couple of days and will be in select theaters next week. It's rated PG. The documentary, The Image Book, is from Jean-Luc Godard. And Peter, you've seen it. What'd you think?
I'm not sure, Larry. I mean,
we'll give you another week. Come on. Yeah,
I mean, this is another sort of infuriatingly incomprehensible Godard movie made up entirely of archival images. He digitally altered them. He bleached and washed them. Most of the imagery is taken from classic movies from the history of film, including Hollywood movies. And so, I mean, after a while, this sort of, for me, was sort of like a very highbrow version of one of those Chuck Braverman montages where, you know, you see a million movies and you have to sort of figure out what the clips are, you know, and I kind of wish that some of them had been identified on the screen, but that would have been, you know, way too plebeian for this film to actually tell you what you're watching. Having said that, there is, you know, some of the imagery is powerful, even though it's all archival. It's the bleaching and so forth gives it a certain shimmer. Godard has his scratchy, gravelly voiceover, you know, which you can you can't understand, really, you know. I mean, thank God there are subtitles, but, you know, and there's all sort of highfalutin stuff about, you know, you have to think with your hands and you separate the sound. I mean, go see it if you're a Godard completist.
The Image Book from Jean-Luc Godard. It's at the American Cinematheque at the Aero Theater in Santa Monica. The film is unrated. Coming up, we'll talk about The Breaker Upperers, a New Zealand romantic comedy, and A Tuba to Cuba, a documentary about the leader of the wonderful Preservation Hall Jazz Band searching for his family's musical and geographic roots. We'll talk about that and also hear what Peter has to say about the Santa Barbara Annual Film Festival, some of his favorites that were screened there. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Much more to talk about, including some of our listeners' favorite remakes of foreign language films. Back shortly. I look forward every week to Film Week, get together with our terrific critics, talk about the movies as we're doing, but also special topics. We'll do that in a moment with Peter Rayner and the Santa Barbara Film Festival. And I also ask you your favorite American remake of a foreign language film. That, of course, because of Alita Battle Angel, which is out this week. I'm joined by critics Peter Rayner, Charles Solomon, and Amy Nicholson. The Breaker Upperers is a New Zealand romantic comedy starring Madeline Sami and Jackie Van Beek. It's written and directed by Sami and Van Beek. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, I'm going to use the word I've been using about pretty much every review so far, which is this movie is super, super fun. What this movie is about...
Nothing wrong with a week of fun movies.
This is a good date week movie. Y'all,
if you're a goth.
Yeah. Although this movie is actually on Netflix right now. What this movie is about is, you know, these two women, Madeline Sami and Jackie Van Beek, they're New Zealand comedians. You have seen them in the back of a lot of films with Taika Waititi and Jemaine Clement. This is their first star role that's making it here with Taika Waititi producing. So it has that New Zealand style of humor where everybody's very nervous and polite and they're stumbling over their own sentences and everyone's awkward, that kind of what we do in the shadows type of humor. In the service of a plot that's like really wicked and mean, at least for the first hour, the setup here is that Madeline and Jackie, their characters Jen and Mel, they met 15 years ago when they realized they were dating the same man. And since then, they've become incredibly bitter about romance, and they have formed a company where they break up your relationship. If you're too nice and nervous to do it yourself, they will disrupt your wedding wearing a pregnant belly. They will fake your own death. They will do whatever it takes to get you out of your unhappy relationship, even if the other person's very nice and showing up at their office like, I'm so sad he's dead. Can we talk about it? And so it's just, I mean, the first half of this movie is almost half montage, you know, just like all these different breakups. And it's terrifically fun, you know, and in the second half, they have to build towards an actual story and everybody gets a Ooh. Hug. It climaxes with a soul train. You know, this is a very, very nice film in the final part. But my gosh, it's so funny and terrific at the beginning.
I think you could run that service off the internet.
The Breaker Upperers is streaming on Netflix. It's unrated, written and directed by and starring Madeline Sami and Jackie Van Beek. A Tuba to Cuba follows the leader of the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, looking for his late father's family background by going to Cuba. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, this is hosted by Ron Jaffe, whose parents created Preservation Hall. I assumed it was something much older. It was something they started, I guess, in the early 60s. And who doesn't love the Preservation Hall Jazz Band? And they go to Cuba, you know, jam with Cuban musicians there. There's a very interesting sequence where they look at one particular kind of Cuban jazz that's descended from African slaves imitating and parodying the formal dances that their French masters had done. And you can see in this much more jazzy, fluid, rhythmic forms the echoes of the old figure dances. And there's a very touching moment where one of the Cubans has a rock that his family tradition maintains, an ancestor who was enslaved, kept with him from Africa. It was a little piece of his home that he kept with him. And when one of the American black musicians sees it, he's moved to tears. The weak spot of this movie, though, is that he talks about the links between New Orleans jazz and Cuban influences and doesn't really explore those. I don't think I
That's
learned.
That's a very rich subject here.
Yeah, I don't think I learned as much about it as I would have liked to, but it's a very warm, very winning film. And again, these people are all clearly having so much fun, both the musicians from both places and the audiences that you'd have to be a real Grinch not to, to be carried along with it.
Well, as a big fan of the band, I've checked out the film. Sounds great. Tuba to Cuba is unrated. It's at Limley's Glendale Theater. Let's turn our attention now to the Santa Barbara Film Festival. Peter is there every year. And Peter, you have several films that you particularly enjoyed. First of all, the overall festival itself.
It was, except for some polar vortex weather and some downpours. Viggo Mortensen was given a tribute. He had to be flown in by helicopter from Camarillo to attend his tribute. Michael B. Jordan was there. It was sort of like the Beatles had arrived, you know, with all the screaming. And he explained that he wasn't named after the basketball player, but after his father, who was also named Michael Jordan. Melissa McCarthy and Glenn Close and many others are there. It was all very, you know, informative. They also have a ton of movies that they show, often out-of-the-way indie movies and docs and films that, you know, are waiting to be picked up. And so I'll talk about
Zulu
some of those.
Yeah, Zulu Summer, do you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, Zulu Summer is a very interesting movie, and it's the perfect public radio movie, too. There was a His Royal Highness Prince Sibanye-Iso Tobu Zulu from South Africa wanted to learn more about America. And so he reached out to all of these, you know, public radio stations in America and got a response from a small community station, low wattage, in Butte, Montana. So lo and behold, the prince and several of his associates show up in Butte, you know, in full African regalia. They're greeted at the airport, and they spent, I think, the better part of the summer interacting with the community. Had a radio show while they were there. They were part of a July 4th a parade. They spoke at the Evel Knievel Festival that they have every year.
They really did get America.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they met Bernie Sanders. They went to barbecues, and I mean, it was just. But it's you know, when you keep waiting for something horrible to happen, you know, some racist something or other to encroach, and nothing ever happens. I don't know that it's the most racially mixed community in America. And
Butte, Montana, probably not.
I mean, there is a scene that was cut out, according to the director, you know, the Joseph Linziger and Eric Schrader, where they meet with the Creek Indians. That's not in the film. But I wonder if there was any African-Americans at all in Butte, because we don't see them interact with the Zulus. But it's just a wonderful, you know, very heartwarming in the best sense movie that really gives you a sense of you know, people coming together from totally different cultures, and seeing these guys, you know, going all around Butte and getting, you know, interacting with these people who are both, you know, sort of appreciative and goggle-eyed is just a lot of fun.
When I was a teenager, our next door neighbors in the Hollywood Hills, Japanese American man whose family ran the only Chinese restaurant in Butte, Montana.
Really?
Yes. And in fact, they weren't interned because, you know, being so far inland, running this old Chinese restaurant,
right.
They were not interned during World War II. But he had stories about growing up in Butte being
what
Japanese
is it about
American.
Butte?
Well, I remember NPR always used to have, all things considered, have Kim Williams from Butte going out picking wild rose hips for tea and things.
So yep. That's Zulu Summer. Real quickly, Echo in the Canyon, which is Laurel Canyon in the music scene?
Yeah, it's the Laurel Canyon music scene in the mid-60s and how folk rock sort of grew out of that. Jacob Dylan, the son of Bob Dylan, is a featured player in it. It was directed by Andrew Slater. And there are all sorts of great interviews with Eric Clapton, Stephen Stills, Graham Nash, Crosby, Jackson Browne, Brian Wilson, many others, all talking about that era. And there are clips of them, you know, both from the 60s. You know, there's also, you know, the Mamas and the Papas and Buffalo Springfield. There's also part of a clip from a 2015 tribute concert. It really is a marvelous music documentary that has been picked up by Greenwich Film. So it will be distributed at some point this year, hopefully. But it really does give you a sense of that community in Laurel Canyon.
Every time I drive down Laurel Canyon, it's what comes to mind. I look at, who lived in that house? And who, because it's just, it's so much a part of the mythos
Yeah, I mean, and they all went, you know, they all jammed in each other's living rooms, and they talk about that in the film. You know, and the funniest part is when Crosby is talking to Jacob about Dylan, and Jacob goes, you'll have to be more specific. Who are you talking about?
We're almost out of time. That's Echo in the Canyon. Angel Face, can you give us 30 seconds on that film?
Yes. Marion Cotillard gives a terrific performance. It's an uneven movie, but you know, she is always terrific. And Ash's Purest White is the new film from Gia Jonquet, which is quite interesting and will be opening in a month here.
All right, very good. Those few of the highlights from the Santa Barbara Film Festival. Peter Rayner, just back from there, it went through last weekend. Coming up, we'll talk about what are some of our critics' favorite remakes of foreign language films into American movies. That very much thematic with this week's opening of Alita: Battle Angel. We'll be talking about that, and you can post your suggestions on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Every few weeks we get, it seems, a remake of a foreign language film in which an American filmmaker or the original director, screenwriter of the foreign language film gets a crack at doing it in English. Most of them don't measure up to the original source material, but there are a few that have really stood out over the years. And I wanted to hear from our critics, Charles Solomon, Amy Nicholson, and Peter Rayner, their thoughts. Charles, you have a particular strong remake that stands out to you?
I've been trying to think of one, and the animated ones have all been pretty disastrous. When you think about, like, the Dragon Ball movie or Speed Racer or Ghost in the Shell, and heaven help us, somebody's going to try and do a live remake of Cowboy Bebop. So I think I'm going to have to pass to my more knowledgeable live action co-panelists on this one, because I keep drawing a blank.
Really, Amy?
You know, there is a cult of Speed Racer, right? People yes. love the American Speed Racer.
Well, I mean, it was translated, but the live action, the recent film they made, you couldn't tell where they were in the race.
I just remember the earworm theme song from Speed Racer.
Well, for me, the one that comes to mind and is that I really love the American version of Let the Right One In, called Let Me In Here, done by Matt Reeves. I actually think it's superior to the Swedish version. This is the film about the young boy who falls in love with the young girl vampire who lives in his apartment complex, who lives with her older handler. And in the American version, the older handler, who's also her ex-boyfriend from when he was young and a child, is played by Richard Jenkins. And I just think Richard Jenkins' performance is so superior to the Swedish actor, who is great, but it's Richard Jenkins, one of our greatest living treasures. That character, which I believe is so much the fulcrum of the movie beyond the two young vampire teens, that it's superior. And also, you know, there are no animated cats in the American remake. So I love Let Me In.
Boingo writes on the page, David Fincher's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the English language. I don't know whether you preferred that or not.
Would you count Star Wars and The Hidden Fortress?
I don't. You can count whatever you want, Charles.
Would that count as
I think the short answer might be
that
no.
was unacknowledged for a time, right? Also, Triumph of the Will is part two. Yes, I've prepared for this, Larry.
Yeah,
so,
good. I see you.
So I'll just Voodoo Safe from Drowning, Jean Renoir's great movie with Michelle Simone, was made as Down and Out in Beverly Hills with Nick Nolte. Another great Renoir movie, La Chienne, was made into a terrific noir with Edward G. Robinson called Scarlet Street.
I love Scarlet Street.
Fritz Lang directed. Yeah. La Jetée, the great Chris Marker short film, 12 Monkeys, was Terry Gilliam. Ossessione, which was a great neorealist picture by Visconti, was made several times. The Postman Always Rings Twice.
I didn't know that was based on.
Yeah, in fact, it wasn't. It couldn't be shown in America for many years, the Italian film, because of rights problems with James M. Cain. But it was. It's the same story.
Yeah, because it's an American novelist, I just assumed it would first be made here.
Right. No, it was made there. I guess because they're sultrier in Italy and they get around the
source
ratings.
Source material a little racy. Yeah.
Right. Right. And then La Cage aux Folles became The Birdcage, which was very entertaining. Pepe Lamoco was made almost shot for shot as Algiers with Hedy Lamarr. And Charles Boyer, the great Now, Smiles of a Summer Night, the great Bergman movie, was a Little Night Music, which some people don't realize.
That was via the stage.
Right. But, yeah, it was made into a film. Seven Samurai, of course, was Magnificent Seven, and Yojimbo was Fistful of Dollars. Solaris was remade not very well, the Tarkovsky film in Hollywood by Soderbergh, I believe, yeah. And, you know, I mean, there are a lot of it. Victoria was actually a German movie that was made
really?
By Blake Edwards.
Yeah, hard to believe that was better than the Blake Edwards version, which is so good. Yeah.
You're just reminding me, Peter, there have been several versions of the Viennese comedy that The Matchmaker is based on, and including Hello, Dolly.
Right. Sure. Blake Edwards also did a remake of the Truffaut film, The Man Who Loved Women. And, of course, there's the great Purple Noon, Patricia Highsmith, Rene Clément film with Alain Delon, which was remade as Talented Mr. Ripley.
Which was terrific film. Yeah. You got those are some great examples.
But, Peter, do you prefer The Magnificent Seven to Seven Samurai?
Are you kidding? I like Magnificent Seven
great?
A lot.
Yeah, they're both great.
I mean,
great films.
We're talking amazingly great to very good, but I'll take it.
Okay.
You know. Yeah, one of the big challenges, of course, is to take something that's specifically cultural and not ruin it in remaking it. And that's difficult. We had more recently, didn't we have the film Intouchables was remade?
Right. That was one. The Upside was with Bryan Cranston. Also, not many people know that the Kindergarten Teacher with Maggie Gyllenhaal that came out earlier this year was based on an Israeli movie.
Yeah, and so what advice do you have for filmmakers adapt? Do you try and keep it as culturally specific, but just in English, or is that a road to disaster to do that?
I think it's sort of a disaster. I mean, my feeling is it's the same thing with, you know, don't remake a great movie. Remake a movie that could have been great but didn't work, you know, and then but if you do something culturally so different that you're essentially taking the same story, but you're transposing it into an entirely different realm, I think that's the best. So Boudou Saved from Drowning is, you know, this homeless hobo who is played by Michelle Simone, you know, wonderfully sloppy, great actor, you know, falls into the sin. And then you transpose it to Beverly Hills and Nick Nolte and Richard Dreyfuss and Bette Midler. I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah. There's just so many of these remakes that
I had forgotten Victor Victoria, which was a movie I really liked.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of films that we don't even – Some Like It Hot is actually based on an old German film. I've never seen it. But, you know, there are a lot of these movies. The Departed, the Scorsese film, is based on a Chinese movie called Internal Affairs.
We have EDB writes on the page, Goyokan remade as the Master Gunfighter. And in addition to the Magnificent Seven, Seven Samurai was Battle Beyond the Stars as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But awful examples, according to EDB.
Yeah, right. Can we include Godzilla?
Yeah.
Okay, how many remade in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's right.
How many times?
Although, yeah, but Raymond Burr was cut, inserted into the original, right?
Right.
So was that an American production?
And that was George Takei's first job, was dubbing some of the voices for that, he said.
You're so knowledgeable about Japanese culture, Charles, and how that is in animation. It seems to me, you know, when it comes to Japanese horror, this has been a real challenge, taking these very, you know, things that are perhaps even more frightening because of cultural references, and then figuring out, well, what's an equivalent in American culture?
Well, part of that is that there's a huge Japanese tradition of horror stories, and there are encyclopedias of monsters and kinds of ghosts. So it's something that's very much a part of Japanese culture. In a way, I don't think we have them. There are also degrees of how scary ghosts can be. There's a film that's coming up here called Oko's Inn, where a little girl goes to work in her grandmother's hot springs inn and discovers there's a ghost there of a little boy who loved her grandmother as a little girl. We wouldn't do that.
All right, for our critics, Charles, Amy, and Peter, I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you for joining us. I sure hope to see you Sunday afternoon, 1:30, Theater at Ace Hotel. Our critics on stage, the big screen will show clips of all the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures. It's going to be a wonderful event. Already more than 1,000 tickets sold, and we have some left. Want to make sure that you get in on it. KPECC.org/in-person. Please join us at the historic Theater at Ace Hotel Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, and have a wonderful weekend.